computer's online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek, and today we are speaking to author Max Arvo, who has written 3 articles at Kennedy's and King, and it's Jack Ruby, A Review and Reassessment. Max, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Len.
You're very welcome. I'm just always glad to interview people that are doing good work. You know, you don't have to agree with everyone and everything, but, you know, there are some people that are just not worth talking to. So when anyone's doing some good work, I'm glad to have them on.
Thank you.
So your article is about Jack Ruby. Well, I'll let you get right into it. Tell me what caught your interest and what made you want to write about Jack Ruby and his legal troubles.
Well, I've tried to think about where it started. And I think one of the main starting points was the book Chaos by Tom O'Neill, a great book that came out a few years back. I think he spent 20 years working on that was primarily anchored in the Manson murders, and his research there took him in various directions. And in the book, one of the characters who shows up is Lewis Jolyon West, or otherwise known as Jolly West, who was a psychiatrist who was definitely, I mean, verified work with MK Ultra. And O'Neill describes the ways he was also involved in the Jack Ruby case. And there was things that O'Neill found that hadn't been found before. Part of that came from when West died, he left behind thousands of pages of archives that were donated to UCLA. And O'Neill went to view those before anyone had really viewed them or before they'd even been processed and the contents sort of broken down as they usually are at archives. And so he viewed all of them and found various things that he lays out in Chaos, which suggests that West had a quite startling involvement in the Ruby case. His MK Ultra work in general and his work throughout his career involved things like hypnosis and LSD and inducing insanity and all these things. And O'Neill raised the question of West's involvement. And I think West was known to people in the assassination research world for a while. But I think it was particularly O'Neill's book that brought West's name to the popular consciousness a bit more. And so that book sort of raises this haunting question of what exactly happened to Jack Ruby once he was in prison. And why was this guy, Lewis Jolyon West, who on the surface was just another psychiatric professor or head of the psychiatry department in the University of Oklahoma at that time, why was he brought down and why was he involved? And then a couple of summers ago, I was on a road trip helping a friend move and stopping through LA. And I thought, I don't know why exactly, I don't remember where I got the idea, but I thought, why not stop at the West Archives at UCLA? So I did that and I spent a day there and I viewed all the boxes on the Ruby, but almost all of the boxes on the Ruby case and a couple of others on things like West did another somewhat sinister project in the High Ashbury during the Summer of Love. And I viewed some of those and took photos of them all and had about 2,000 something photos of all the pages. And over the next year, I kept looking through and processing them, sort of hesitant to dive in because I could sense that it could take up a lot of time, as any of these things can easily do. And And then there was a point where a couple of bits of information I ended up finding out in the documents that seemed to be new, sort of updates to O'Neill's account and what was generally known. One of them was that I found letters confirming that West was involved in the Ruby case as early as 29th of November, so only 5 days after Ruby shot Oswald. And the general idea, the general sense of West's involvement is that he was brought in around April of 1964, and just kind of out of the blue gets involved in the case and examines Jack Ruby. And another thing that O'Neill brings up is that right around the time of West's involvement, Jack Ruby has this psychotic break, which means he's amongst other things discredited somewhat as a witness, and there are various other effects of that. So I realized that I had these letters confirming that West was involved in less than a week after Oswald was shot, and that's something that also isn't really discussed by West or anywhere else in the record. And I got in touch with O'Neill, or I was already in touch, I think, and I shared that, and he was interested in that, and then I just kept digging, because I realized at that point that there was something there that I needed to look into, and it just kind of spiraled on from there. I just got very meticulous with it, trying to figure out, well, what evidence is there, like primary evidence is there out there that explains what actually happened, or was it just some bizarre coincidence? It seemed unlikely to me that it was a coincidence, but I wanted to be sure for myself, as sure as I could be. And anyway, long answer, but that's, I guess the core of it.
Right. But for those who are familiar with, or even not, MK Ultra is mind control. And this doctor is notorious, I would say, for being at arm's length away from many cases. Oh, you think, what the hell really went on? And yeah. This idea of being hypno-programmed, or in the case of Saran, he doesn't remember. And you wonder, with all these different MK Ultra experiments and mind control experiments, when they were looking for a Manchurian candidate, someone who they could program to do something, and then he would forget about it. He wouldn't be in any capacity to offer details. I mean, it would be the perfect ploy for them.
Right. If you like, I could, I guess, explain a bit of the context of that whole side of things, the MK Ultra side of things, and the history of that. And
sure, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's something where I think another motivation behind looking into all this was I caught myself sort of accepting quite quickly the idea that implied in Chaos and elsewhere that West and others had done something quite insidious to Ruby, and I sort of worried I was perhaps starting to accept some wild things perhaps a bit too quickly, and I wanted to just check if I was being too eager with these kind of things. And MK Ultra and the whole idea of mind control and Manchurian candidates are, I mean, anyone familiar with the process of coming to terms with the Kennedy assassination or anything like that will know the feeling of that you're getting into something that you're not supposed to, and that people may look at you strangely for. The whole idea of the MK Ultra and mind control things, that's something that's hard to. Well, I was perturbed when I found myself finding it to all seem true and likely that it happened. And what I found in researching all of this is that it was not just some quirky research project or a handful of strange experiments and efforts in the mid-century by a few outliers who were out of control in a time where, you know, people could do what they wanted within the agency and had free rein, and there was a lot of money going around to crazy things. It wasn't that. What it really was something that, I'm not sure its origins go back further, but had its origins particularly in kind of the post-war period, during the war itself, really. A lot of the figures were the lead in the post-war psychiatric and field and MK Ultra. A lot of them were lead very, very senior members of the military medical staff during the war. And during the war, they started doing experiments into things like the idea of a truth drug, which even that still sounds a bit outlandish, but they were very, very serious about it back then. And I think it was around 1943 when those started, and they were particularly looking into things like, well, they tried marijuana at first as something that might work, and they were trying all these things. And so it started back then. The guy who led that was a guy called Winfried Overholser, who was extremely senior and crucial in the post-war period. And anyway, so that at that point had connections to the military and intelligence, OSS and the military. They were all kind of working together to try and find this stuff. And from there, the experiments just kept expanding. And the focus was not really on anything crazy, frankly. It was the idea that people can be manipulated in various ways, which is, I mean, obviously we all know that, and that the people they perceived as their enemies may have had such capabilities. Quickly, before the end of the war, the focus shifted to, Russia, and this idea started spreading that they had these techniques available to brainwash people. And so the programs all kind of emerge out of there, out of this post-war attempt to find the ways by which the mind can be manipulated. To what extent is it possible to control someone? I mean, the idea of the Manchurian Candidate was something, a part of the project and certainly an aim, but it was not just some people thinking, can we create, a human robot assassin hybrid? It ran the gamut of everything, of experiments into what does this particular drug do to someone? What does sleep deprivation do to someone? Does hypnosis work? All these things. And so it was this really expansive body of research into questions of, basically human behavior and human mental manipulation that leads into then scarier and wilder sounding things that we probably hear about first, which are these ideas of creating someone who could kill someone with a command that's given to them under hypnosis, something like that. So I just thought it was helpful to me to realize that it's not just this bizarre outlier over a few years in the middle of the century, but it's this long-running, extensive program with roots that I think anyone can understand, not endorse, but understand that they were trying to figure out how people might be controlled, how their own people might be controlled, and how to resist that if it existed, things like that, or at least that was the justification they offered. So anyway, yeah, just helped me to realize that it wasn't just this crazy, strange thing, but
Right. It sounds like it was somewhat troubling then, because if you were unaware of this was going on at all, studying this case and that doctor, like I mentioned, the word notorious, that's
yes,
it's yeah. Just so like you wouldn't dream that this would be going on, and then you look into it, and how many other times have they done this? I don't want to bring up all other cases right now, but I mean, once you look into it, even Tom's books, Chaos, that's just Chaos. Yeah, just Chaos. Yeah. These are programs that somehow the Department of Defense was funding, and even in the Allen Memorial Hospital, all these different places and universities are getting these funds to do experiment, and you find out about this psychic driving. Yeah. And so many other things that you just go, you got to be kidding me. I mean,
it's terrifying, when you start to look into it and realize the scale of it and how far back the roots go. And I mean, you mentioned that this would definitely be skipping ahead, but you mentioned the various other cases that are where there's something strange, seems to be happening. And obviously Sirhan is probably the one we're most familiar with in that regard. But what I found is, and I don't really get into this in the article or in the articles because it's beyond the scope of it, but what I found during all this research is it was such a small world, basically, of all these people who were in this post-war world of psychiatry. And so many of these names crop up in cases again and again and again over decades. I mean, Bernard Diamond is someone I'm interested in as well, and he was one of the psychiatrists who examined Sirhan and hypnotized him several times, I think was on the defensive side, saying that he was insane. I less on top of the details with the RFK side of things, but Bernard Diamond. Like New West knew all these people. They were all part of, there were a couple of like hypnosis centers that were founded in the post-war period. And it was a really serious, I mean, I don't know what people might, what
well, they
idea
were all people, in this insiders club. And
yes,
later on, and it, you yeah. wonder how could the every guy that you're interested in have such a bad legal defense, and you find out they've all been compromised and they're all there working for some other client to make sure that the truth doesn't come out. I mean, we all know about Saran. The one troubled one that was for me when I heard about John Lennon's assassination, and they said that after he shot him, he just sat down on the curb and started reading, you know, a book. You know, and you go, what right. the hell is that? And I mean, I just interviewed Dave Whalen, who wrote a book, Mind Games and the Assassination of John Lennon, and he just goes through the anomalies of something's not right here. And you don't have to get into all that right now, but it's another thing like that. You go, something's not right here. And we're told that Jack Ruby wanted to spare Jackie a trial, you know, and she suffered enough. And then you find out the defense is he had this epileptic motor seizure and he just pulled the trigger, you know. And that's, I think, what the articles are going into, that a lot of this stuff is so farcical that if you haven't got a handle on even some of the terminology, you just go, well, I don't know what all that's about, and forget that. Then you find this is all impossible gibberish.
Yeah. I just want to step back just to the Lennon situation. Because now I haven't looked into it that much, but as I was going through, just looking into all these various names, one of them that came up was a guy called Milton V. Klein. And he was one of the leading post-war hypnotists. He was verifiably a part of work for the CIA, and actually worked for it as far back as programs which preceded MKUltra, which were Bluebird and Artichoke. And he said, well, he examined Mark David Chapman, and he also said, quite scarily, in an interview just I think the New York Times or something like that. Well, here's the quote from the article. He was outspoken in his belief that one of the central goals of these experiments, to create a hypnotized remote control assassin, was entirely possible, though he denies knowledge of any terminal experiments that would have tested his theories. Klein then emphatically told the reporter that it cannot be done by everyone. It cannot be done consistently, but it can be done. He claimed that given the proper subject and circumstances, by using hypnosis, he could produce such a killer in 3 to 6 weeks. I mean, again, you can believe him or disbelieve him. It's just his word, but he saw Chapman too. And you keep seeing this strangeness of these figures, seeing these people, you know, showing up in all these different cases. So anyway, that's where I've brushed up against the Lennon thing. Is there are a couple of people examined him. Yeah. And
And so it's troubling, but then in the background you find out if it's not Jolly West, it's an associate, or it's this university that and then his organization. Right. Yeah, that's the uncomfortable thing that happens, I think, if you look into this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The threads kind of go in all directions, but they keep heading to the same kinds of events. That they, you know, the same kinds of very significant.
Well, something is just in the news. These two events were two military, ex-military, whatever it is. I haven't had time to really look into it. Mm. One blew up that Tesla car. They're both from Fort Bragg. They both did it.
Yeah.
You know, you got to go, oh, it's still going on today.
Yeah, no, exactly. Those, and it was the same day, and it's, a former military guy, apparently. Oh, yeah, and I mean, this gets dark, but, you know, he was found. Before blowing up the car, he shot himself apparently with one bullet, and he was from Fort Bragg. And then the other guy in the New Orleans thing, he'd been planning it for a long time. And Bragg again, and former military. And I mean, you can't say anything for certain about those, but everything about those just made made those antenna go up for me. It's
right, and average citizen wouldn't even know where to start on that. But at least if you have done some research into this, when we go, there's something wrong, it's going to take a year of research, and you can't count on any governmental agency to do an honest investigation.
No.
All they are is covering it up. And then when you start to realize, case after case, they're covering it up, are they behind out? You know, that's another conclusion. But responsibility is, if they weren't in the planning, they were just saying, we agree, we'll help cover it up.
Mm-hmm.
Or a lack of investigation. There was a good book called The War on Omission. You know, all you have to do is just not investigate, and then what's the, you know, the public going to do?
Well, see, I mean, with Ruby, a good example that people may well be aware of from his Warren Commission interview, which I think was in the first week of June 64, where he's in a room with a couple of his lawyers and Earl Warren, a couple of other commission people, besides all his, I mean, multiple times requesting to them to take him to DC because he said he was in danger and he wanted to tell them the full story, which they denied. One of the things he, talking about Warren Commission, one of the things sorry, it's just completely slipped my mind. I'm so sorry.
If you listen to his interview there's a recording of him asking Earl Warren and other people have read the testimony saying, you've got to get me out of here. I can't tell you what I want to tell you, but I've got a lot to say and I don't feel safe here. And, you know, if you want to know the truth, get me in front of the president and I will talk, right? And they go, I'm sorry, we just don't have the ability to, you know, for security. Yeah. I mean, the poverty of some of those answers, you know.
Yeah, and that interview on the Warren side of things is kind of a masterclass in just closing down opportunities for Ruby to say anything. I mean, it's so clearly focused on limiting the focus and on keeping it as brief as possible and on not, again, I mean, this, I guess, this sort of sounds probably like a completely naive way of looking at things for anyone listening, but it's supposed to be an attempt to figure out who killed the president of the United States. And you'd think that you would leave no stone unturned.
Oh, yeah. You know, if you didn't have any stake in the outcome, anybody, if it was about a car crash or something, you'd say, ask the question. Well, the guy's begging you, you know. And in a bit of nice irony, in the movie JFK, Oliver Stone got the real Jim Garrison to play Earl Warren scene where he's, I'm just sorry, Mr. Ruby, we haven't got the manpower for protection. And like I said, when you read these questions and answers, you called it a masterclass. It really is. It's like at every opportunity, he's handcuffing, I'm sorry, we can't. And you go, well, what are you here for then?
Yeah, and I mean, things like that, you know, it's part of the challenge. And I still have my own personal sort of struggle with all this stuff because partly because there's just so much in culture that pushes you to stay away from all these kind of things. And that was partly what motivated the article, was trying to just figure out, all right, if I look at this myself, what can I find? And yeah, I mean, that's something where it's like, okay, so the official story is that they did the best investigation they could, setting aside the conclusions of even the later congressional investigations, but they did the best they could and they concluded that, you know, it was this one guy up there, Oswald, and that Ruby was almost as much of a lone nut as Oswald. And they asked him and they spoke to him and they did their best. But, you know, if you look at it and you realize the extent to which they're closing off avenues of information and questioning that seem important, I feel like anyone can't help but look at that and go, well, why? And then you follow from there, you think, well, did they know there was something or there were things in general that they should stay away from? And then if that's the case, then the next step is, well, then they weren't interested in finding out exactly what happened. And if that's the case, then you're immediately at the level of a cover up at the highest possible level. And it's just, yeah, it's just another one of those things that keeps cropping up. I mean, of course, everyone listening, I'm sure, is well aware of this feeling, but, you know, every step of the way, and you can lose sight of it, I think, quite easily. But at every step of the way, there are these aspects to things that just make you, if you just sit with them for a second, it's sort of, you feel crazy to believe the official story, you know, and the implications are always.
Yeah. In your research, what was the first thing, if you remember, that jumped out that caught your attention and said, there's something wrong here?
Well, the thing that I first found that was, I think, a new discovery was the documents that specifically confirmed West was involved by November 29th, 5 days after Ruby kills Oswald. Now, that is, I mean, it's less than a week. That's very, very soon. And again, if you just compare it to the official story, and I think, you know, again, it can sound naive because I'm sure everyone listening doesn't believe it. But if you just compare what is still the official story to this day, it's that Ruby was a guy who kind of a hanger-on in Dallas. He had lots of friends with the police department, but that was all just because, I don't know, maybe that was a bit of a coincidence, you know. And he ran a strip club, and he was sort of, he got emotional, he got angry, and in a fit of emotion, righteous vigilante-ish rage, he happens to be there when Oswald's walking out, and he shoots him with just one bullet and kills him. And so if that's the case, and there's no evidence that he was actually insane at the time or before, you know, but if that's the case, then why is this psychiatrist involved 5 days afterwards? And his efforts there are working on getting a panel of psychiatric experts appointed to the Ruby case. And 5 days afterwards stood out to me as a bizarrely brief period of time in which this guy who, I think he was in his mid-30s, you know, who is an MK Ultra, verifiably an MK Ultra psychiatrist, to be involved. Why was he thinking about it? Why was he so concerned with the insanity of alleged insanity of Jack Ruby? You know, he worked in Oklahoma. He was the head of the psychiatry department there. You know, why? That just stands out as just the speed of that involvement was startling. And it's not commented on. You know, in the popular record, it's basically that West only has really appeared over time, perhaps more differently in the last few years, but generally he's appeared as someone who was involved, you know, once Ruby was convicted, and only very briefly, in around March, April, May of 64. And he came in to examine him just as a psychiatric expert. Again, for some reason he's picked, but and he sees him, and around about the time, and we were able to pin down the details of this more, but around about that time, Jack Ruby had a psychotic break. That's just the story. But the fact that he was involved 5 days after, I mean, it may be earlier, but the earliest I could find was 5 days. Evidence I could find put it at 5 days. That was the first thing. And that's not discussed. And even when he joins the case, he doesn't mention how early he was involved in any of his records, and it's not mentioned anywhere. That was what first stood out.
And he's not defense counsel, you know.
He's no, lawyer, he's not.
So,
yeah.
You know, so his line of work is something else, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he. I also was trying to figure out the nature of that early involvement. So Tom O'Neill had found some stuff in his paper, in West papers, that pointed to his involvement being around at that time, and he hadn't confirmed exactly how early it was. So it was maybe, well, it certainly hadn't confirmed that it was 5 days, but it was something about appointing a panel of experts. And so I looked into that as much as I could, and I fleshed out basically that whole story. And what I found there was that, again, it's not clear exactly where that came from or who asked, if someone did, who asked West to start doing that. But West contacted a guy in Dallas, and I dug this up just from looking at the old newspaper articles from the time, and they were just reported on the day in Oklahoma papers. That was it. And I think maybe one Texas paper. He contacted a guy called Charles W. Webster, and Webster was a lawyer in Dallas who actually, and I don't think I get into this in the article because there wasn't space, but he worked at, I think, Southern Methodist University in Dallas, and he set up and ran a program for training law enforcement there. And on 11/22, on the day of the assassination, he was in the Dallas Police Department alongside other ACLU people. So he was there, and this is the guy that West, for some reason, contacts out the blue. The year before, I was digging into all these names, and again, I didn't get to this in the article, but I think this is really interesting. The year before, he'd been the lawyer for, and I'm going to start throwing out probably lots of names, and it's easy to get lost with these, but I'll do my best to try and keep it coherent. He was the lawyer for Dr. Robert Stubblefield, who was also one of the doctors who examined Ruby. And Stubblefield in 62 was appointed by the court to examine General Edwin Walker when he was arrested after stoking race riots in the South. And the government, I think under Bobby Kennedy, were particularly pushing that. And Stubblefield was appointed, and Webster was his lawyer. And two other doctors he brought in, I forget one of them, but the second he brought on was Andrew Watson, who is another name I'm sure nobody's really heard of, but I recognize that because I'd seen all the documents from the West papers that he was a close friend of Jolly West's, and West ended up getting him to examine Ruby with him and on his own in 1965, and he was writing to him about the case throughout. So it's this small world where, for some reason, that was that guy, Charles Webster, who was in Dallas Police Department on 1122 and was a lawyer who worked with Dallas law enforcement. That was the guy West contacted in Dallas to, as he said it, be the spokesperson for this group to get these experts appointed. And this is 5 days after Ruby shot Oswald. I mean, all this effort to get these psychiatric experts appointed 5 days after is, it just struck me as odd. There was no, as far as I could see on the surface, no reason to be so motivated. And then I started looking into other things and, you know, checking the other names that were involved by that time. And West was contacting a guy called Henry Weihoffen, who was a professor of law in New Mexico and a longtime colleague of Winfred Overholser, who I mentioned already. And Weihoffen was a law professor who, so he got, West got him to write a memo explaining the legal precedent for having this panel of experts appointed, which he did. And he sent that to him on the 30th and references West calling him late the previous night, so on the 29th. And all those articles about Webster and all that were on the 30th and the 29th as well. So it all kind of kicked off around, well, verifiably, at least as early as the 29th. And he's got, you know, he's checking with law professors around the country and getting all these people involved. And then he was also contacting other psychiatrists to get their names signed up. And I think Stubblefield had already agreed to join in by that point. Another name that crops up is a guy called Gene Usden, who there's no reason why anyone would know that name, but he, in a letter in West Papers, wrote to the head of the American Psychiatric Association in January 64, confirming that he'd agreed to be a part of that team. That guy, Usden, was a, for some reason, you know, is getting asked to join in on this. He was a senior psychiatrist with the Ochsner Clinic, you know, run by Alton Ochsner down in New Orleans, which there's lots of rumors about. And so it's this weird small group of people and this huge effort from a guy based in Oklahoma within 5 days to get all these people involved. And I kept looking into it. What became clear was that West wasn't, at a glance you'd think this was obvious, but you can verify it, that he wasn't working impartially at all. And there are references and letters throughout that point to West having a direct connection to the defense itself. I mean, in some letters, he refers to things that the defense are going to do before their public knowledge. And obviously, he ends up being appointed by the defense, you know, a few months later. So from what I saw, he was clearly working for the defense, or at least had, you know, some connection. And yeah, sorry, that was just because he said he wasn't defense counsel, all of that. But he said he was impartial and the whole effort was to get impartial examiners. But I see no evidence that he was, well, if he was working for any side, it was certainly the defense and not the prosecution. But yeah.
Yeah, right. So we'll go through this part 1, 2, and 3 already up at Kennedy's and King. When your title is reassessment, I mean a review and reassessment, but... Well, tell me what you mean by that, then.
Well, I think that was Jim's title, and it's appropriate. It was what became apparent was that, understandably, less attention had been paid to what happened to Ruby after he shot Oswald. I mean, God knows there's enough in those 2 days between, you know, on the 22nd and the 24th for anyone to spend forever looking into just, you know, any particular detail. And at first glance, it seems like, why would the Ruby case be of interest? Because, you know, we know he killed Oswald. It's one of the few things that about the whole thing that isn't really up for debate. You can watch it on YouTube. You know, you can watch him. And by the way, it was the first televised murder, first live televised murder, which is sort of a startling thing. A lot of significant things happened that weekend. And so we know he killed him, and then he's convicted of murder pretty quickly in March. And so why would there be any reason to really look at that? And so, yeah, just as I kept looking at all the different materials, it became clear that there's a lot of contradictory information, and it's dense, and there's every reason sort of pushing you to stay away. And yeah, I realized that as I was going through it, it was worth it to review all the material that was out there and to reassess it kind of. You can line up various accounts of the Ruby trial, and you can see the ways they differ and change, and you can add in information that isn't mentioned. And for example, in there's a few books of Ruby's life, and you know, West is barely mentioned, and in general, the details of what happened then haven't really been looked at much, which again is totally understandable. But yeah, that was where it came from, the sense of let's just look back at all this and see what's there.
Yeah, and to me, the reassessment is that what the Warren Commission tried to tell you, he was a patriotic nightclub owner.
And yeah, that, I mean,
just a few little things further on, and then he wasn't really there to kill anybody, and it was just a epileptic motor, whatever the proper term was, you know, impulse that that's yeah. why he did it, you know. And then so everyone go back to sleep. This is the reassessment that no, I think he was under pressure there, and then later mm-hmm. he had some pressure. He wanted to get things off his chest, and no mm-hmm. one would listen to him. I think mm-hmm. there was even some trouble with the lie detector that he wanted to have. Mm-hmm. So is it just, do you split these into three because it was too long for one article?
Yeah, that, and also thanks again to Jim, by the way, for his, I've said it to him personally, but his patience and his support. I mean, I think at first he asked me to try and get it into about 7,000 words, and the whole thing is a fair bit longer than that. But it was worth it. And yeah, the different parts kind of break down into, they have distinct, you know, different focuses. The first part ended up being particularly about Melvin Belli getting involved, who was the, you know, the already nationally famous lawyer who was the defense lead throughout the Ruby trial. And so it was, I touch on his involvement and briefly on
right.
the
we should
very
just discuss
lawyer.
That, right? Because he's the one that started, like, for instance, as a defense, oh, an insanity plea or right. Psychomotor epilepsy. And
yeah.
And Melvin Belli seems to be obfuscating, just trying to do anything but, you know, discuss what the truth was.
Yeah, that was another thing where, as I was looking into this, I just had to, the Belli thing and just who exactly was representing Ruby and when was difficult to even, you know, figure out for sure. And that was something that ended up taking a lot of research, just trying to figure out who was actually involved and when. And yes, yeah, so his first lawyer was Tom Howard, who was a Dallas lawyer who actually had his offices right across the street from the police. Well, there's a whole lot you can say about him, but like he was in the police department when Oswald was shot. And within about an hour or two of Ruby shooting Oswald, he was filing a motion of habeas corpus. So basically to get him released on bond because Oswald wasn't dead yet. So it wasn't a full murder charge. And so he's already for some reason involved within, you know, within a couple of hours working for him. And then later on, Ruby says to a lawyer who would join him later, Joe Tonahill, he says to him, I think the quote is something like, Joe, you should know this. It was Tom who first asked me to say that I did it to save Jackie and the kids the trouble. So Howard's already there in the department and working for, quickly. And I found that he was the first who mentioned, I think it was, may have been by the 25th or within a day, he said to the press, I don't believe he was in his right mind at the time of the shooting, indicating that the defense would be insanity. But that's all he said. And there wasn't really any evidence at that point that Ruby had not been in his right mind. That was just coming from him. And that there's still, I don't think there's any evidence that he was not in his right mind, or at least not just completely deranged, as they were trying to say. In their defense, if you've got a defendant who on live TV in front of millions shot and killed someone, you don't really have many options. And typically just about the only thing you can try in such a case is to just try the insanity defense. So he sort of mentions that, but then within a day or so, but then as I was looking into how and when did Melvin Belli get involved, and this is what I lay out in the first part, it becomes clear he was involved within a week as well, even though the public record generally and at the time was that he was involved by mid-December. But no, he was involved I mean, according to his own account, by 27th or the 28th at the latest. And he's involved, and this is what I discuss in part one. He gets involved because Earl Ruby, Jack Ruby's brother, goes out to LA within a couple of days of Ruby shooting Oswald to, well, the story is to raise, to sell the rights to his Ruby's Jack's story to raise funds for the defense. Which again, I sort of think, like, can't you do that over the phone? Your brothers have just been just killed the alleged assassin of the president on TV. Your priority is flying to LA within 2 days to sell the rights to the story. But he does that. And as I was looking into that, the story of that is strange. I mean, Earl said that the reason he went was because Jack had given him a number on the 25th from jail saying, call this guy. The name's Mike Shaw. And so as I look into that, all of their accounts contradict each other constantly. And Earl contradicts himself, I mean, within sentences several times. And what he ends up saying, despite his contradictions, is that Belli was already there when he went to LA and he met with him and this guy, Billy Woodfield, who was a close friend of Sinatra. And Belli said that that day he signed up to the case. But then publicly, you know, when he first got to Dallas, it was around, like, I think December 20th or December 10th, I think. He was still saying, oh, I'm not sure if I'm going to take the case. I don't know. I'm deciding. But his own account is that he was involved within 3 or 4 days of the case. And so again, like with West, that was something that stood out to me, where it's like West didn't mention it, but he was involved within days. I mean, within a week. And Belli didn't mention it at the time, but he was involved within days. And it seems even that, I mean, if you follow the implication that, well, that I make in the first part, which is that if you lay out all the details, it looks like Jack Ruby told his brother Earl to call Mike Shaw, this guy in LA, and Belli was already there, and they'd mentioned Belli on the phone. It sort of starts to look to me as though they already had these things sort of planned out to some extent. That's honestly what it looks like to me, you know, ready to go. And so, yeah, that's I discuss Belli's involvement in part one particularly, and yeah, just when you look at the details, it's kind of startling.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable because you think everything about, quote, government is there to protect mm-hmm. your way of life and a Justice Department that's on the up and up. And then the fix is in from Chief Justice Earl Warren on down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
let's get into part two then,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
because you mentioned the three psychiatrists that are there.
So, yeah, and part two particularly focuses on a name which I don't think has been mentioned much. And I think Jim said that he was, it's not a name he's encountered much in all his research. And that name is Hubert Winston Smith. And he became someone who I kept finding more and more about. But he's barely, I mean, if Jolly West is not mentioned much in the Ruby accounts, Hubert Winston Smith in the biographies of Ruby will have at most one sentence. And the reference is to, so Hubert Winston Smith, in what was officially known, became the defense lead after Ruby was convicted. So Belli's dropped very shortly. And this is another thing that was difficult, by the way, and that has, I think, kept people away from it for so long. It's just the number of lawyers involved and how quickly there are all these changes and just all the details. It is so convoluted and confusing. And just passing it all and figuring out who's involved and when was a nuisance. But yeah, so the record with Hubert Winston Smith is just that he was involved, I think, around March 24th. Ruby was convicted on the 14th. There's one other lawyer was involved for about 2 days and then quit. And then it was Hubert Winston Smith. So he's involved from around then. And then he leaves in, I think, early June. And so I remember I worked it out. He was only involved for, I think, 72 days. And after Ruby's convicted. So it's another one of those cases of why would you look at him? But the reason I did was because he appointed West. And that's basically the only detail that anyone's discussed about him in the years since, is that he was briefly defense lead and he was the one who appointed West. That's it. So then I thought, well, if something untoward maybe happened, or just even more simply, why? Why did he appoint West over all the other psychiatrists in the country and all the ones in Texas or in Dallas itself? Why go to West? And so I started looking into Winston Smith, and it became clear that he was also involved within days of the assassination, well, of Kennedy and Oswald. And then I started looking, you know, into him further, and became clear he was a friend of Melvin Belli and several of Melvin Belli's law partners since the 40s. He was a friend of Joe Tonahill, who was the other prominent lawyer on the defense, Ruby defense team, who Melvin Belli brought on since the 40s. Yeah, and his focus was particularly on the connections between law and science. He had PhDs in both, in medicine and in, well, he had degrees in law and medicine. And then looking at the accounts, I realized that he appointed the three doctors that the defense used, the Belli. So the general understanding is that Belli appointed them, but even in Belli's own account, in his own book called Dallas Justice, he says that they came from Smith at his recommendation. And they were Stubblefield, who I think I already mentioned as one of the ones who was represented Walker the previous year, or examined Walker the previous year. There was Stubblefield and Walter Bromberg and Manfred Guttmacher, who were very senior, nationally renowned psychiatrists. And so those all came from this guy, Hubert Winston Smith, not from Belli. And so at that point, I started realizing, well, there's more here to the than just this local lawyer who happened to be on the case and happened to pick West. He picked the three doctors who were brought on, and they examined Ruby by mid-December. So he must have been involved, at least with just that bit of evidence, by, you know, within a few weeks. And then I, one thing that really helped me figure it out was I realized he'd been at the University of Texas at Austin at the law school at the time. And I live in Austin now. And I thought, and there was some mystery around why exactly he left. It seemed like he was fired after some difficulty in around 66 or 65. But that detail, the details of what happened there weren't clear. So I figured I'll just reach out to the law department or to the archives and see if there's see if they have any details about why the professor of theirs was let go back then. And they let me know that they actually had, or that they didn't, but that they could, you know, direct me to the archives. And they said that they had a collection of Hubert Winston Smith papers. But when you go online to the law library, those archives weren't listed. It wasn't even online. And they sent me the finding aid for those, which is clearly this old document that had been scanned and prepared a long time ago. And I'm not sure if anyone's really looked at them, because you wouldn't even have any ability to know that they existed if you hadn't happened to ask if they had any papers from Hubert Winston Smith, which, you know, nobody would have any reason to ask, really. So I went and viewed those, and what I found in there was extensive correspondence with all of these names, with Manfred Guttmacher, Walter Bromberg, Melvin Belli, Stubblefield, all these people. So he was clearly this. It was clear that it all came from, or that certainly, yeah, you know, I think it's fair to say it all came from Hubert Winston Smith. And as I think Jim's pointed out, the general sense is that it was Melvin Belli who shaped the whole thing. But at that point, I started to realize, no. It looks like it's Hubert Winston Smith who shaped the defense, and that Belli just, to some extent, I mean, this is what I believe now, Belli just was kind of just the front man for it and just presented it, but it wasn't the crucial. I can't find any element that he seems to have actually put together himself. That was how I started realizing there's something here with Smith, and I also found there various records from something Smith had started called the Law Science Academy, and he also started a foundation, and that operated at that time out of the University of Texas Austin. And it was this thing where he would get psychiatrists and lawyers, medical professionals and lawyers from around the country to meet for various courses, kind of seminars or symposia, discussing various issues as regarding the relation between the latest medical science and the law. And they had been going on for over a decade. And I looked, and it had all the course catalogs for all those years and his correspondence about it all. And I started just looking at those, and there were so many names showed up including all of these people who are involved in the Ruby case. And one that really stood out was, I think it was February 1959. It was in New Orleans, where Smith had been a lawyer at, before he went to Texas at Tulane. And at that 1959 course, lo and behold, so 4 years before it, you've got Joe Tonahill there, who was the Texas lawyer who Belli brought on and represented Ruby. You've got, well, and Jolly West was there. So he, Smith and West knew each other at least since 1959, even though they said, or that they seem to imply that they didn't know each other at all. They'd known each other for over 4 years. Stuart Wolfe, a mentor of Jolly West and another MKUltra guy, was also there. And so was Alton Ochsner, the far right firebrand and surgeon who ran a clinic out of New Orleans and also was the major figure, I think, founder of INCA, that organization that was
International Council of the Americas.
There we go. Yeah, all about anti-communism, and I think actually was the one that organized the TV debate between Oswald and, was it Bringuier. I think, well, they may have been involved.
Conversation Carte Blanche is one of them, and
right, yeah.
Oh, yeah, the name escapes me this second.
Right, yeah, but so yeah, Ochsner was there, and West, and Tonahill, and if you look back through the courses, you see that all these people, like Stubblefield and another guy called Robert Beavers, who was another guy brought on by Smith to the Ruby case. He was also a long-time participant.
Mind control and psychiatric experimentation,
yes,
on behalf of the Department of Defense or the military intelligence angle. This is,
yes,
not up and up stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And lawyers. I mean, Melvin Belli attended, his partner Lou Ash did, all these people. I mean, at that point, I realized that everyone who was involved in this Ruby thing, in the Ruby case, was a longtime friend and colleague of Hubert Winston Smith. So that's what I lay out in part two, is who Smith was and the nature of his involvement. And so again, like all these other characters, he was involved extremely soon after it began. That involvement was not divulged. I think he basically shaped the entire defense. He was also, I think I already said, a longtime friend of Melvin Belli. And I found letters between them dating back to the 40s where they discuss all of this, discuss their various, you know, their legal work and things like that. And Belli back then is referring to Smith as, you know, there's some case he's going to be working on. And he says to Smith in the letter, of course, I'll need your help on the psychiatric aspects. So it's kind of obvious to me what the dynamic is there, was there. And yeah, and then the other thing that I get into in part two is this whole bizarre defense of psychomotor epilepsy, which you've alluded to, and I think people may see crop up if they've read about this whole thing. And I can get into that if you like, because that
sure.
is...
think that one of the names of that show was called Latin Listening Post.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah, and that's another thing where Smith had connections to the New Orleans and the Ochsner world and all these far right people. But there's actually a bizarre thing in that Jim Garrison was actually also at that 1959 conference, and I think spoke at a dinner right after West had spoken. So I think I mentioned it in a footnote, but it seems likely that Jim Garrison was probably in a room 4 years before the assassination, listening to a talk by MKUltra psychiatrist Jolly West, who would later, I believe, work to suppress and control Jack Ruby, the connections to the Garrison case are pretty obvious, but one of those weird coincidences, because, so the psychomotor epilepsy defense, that was, as I mentioned, Tom Howard had sort of vaguely said, I think a day or so after the shooting, that he thought Ruby wasn't in his right mind. But there was no detail there. And then suddenly, once Belli's involved, this bizarre idea of psychomotor epilepsy, like really specific defense, appears. And Belli's not a guy who, he wasn't even really, I think, a criminal lawyer. He was, I think, mostly worked on a lot of civil cases and particularly on torts law. He was known as the King of Torts. So the idea that he would out of the blue come up with this very, very specific medical defense and an obscure diagnosis seemed strange. And again, as I was looking into Smith, it became clear that, and then I think Belli mentions, or someone mentioned somewhere that, I think Belli, that Smith had advised him. Yeah, that was it. He had advised him on the psychomotor epileptic aspects of the case. That was, I think, the quote. And then I found a paper from 1953 that Smith wrote on psychomotor epilepsy as illegal, as an insanity defense. And so that paper 10 years before, you look at what he argues and what he suggests for a defense, and it ends up being what happens in the Ruby case 10 years later. And so, yeah, I lay out all of that and the ways it seems that, you know, that came from Smith as well. And I also lay out the ways it was just bizarre and insufficient at the time. It was an obsolete diagnosis, basically, even at that time. And it was based on an idea of epilepsy that has never been true, which is that, specifically the way Smith phrased it, complicated acts could be carried out while under an epileptic episode or just before and after. And by complicated acts, to work as an insanity defense, you have to say that someone, either during an epileptic episode or in the difficult states either side of it, in the case of Ruby, that it was that drove him to kill Lee Harvey Oswald on live TV in the basement of the Dallas Police Department. I mean, that is, seems like a stretch. And so what that then leads to by having that introduced is this whole effort to get all these psychiatrists involved to try and argue that Ruby had this very, very, very specific and obscure form of epilepsy that wasn't even, I also say, you know, even if you were going to argue that, it wasn't even widely accepted diagnosis at the time. And it's not even something that would have ever been possible anyway. So,
right. And it's something that a layperson had never even heard of. And
right,
then you get
right.
One guy after another saying, no, this is possible. And I'll bring in the next expert. And before you know it, you get a team of people testifying that this is what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And now I think, interestingly, it kind of backfired on them because, well, there are accounts of, by the end of it, just the jurors being just worn out by a procession. I mean, they're going in to see a trial of a guy who, I mean, had killed someone on live TV, and suddenly they're getting this, I think, dry series of involved medical testimony from various psychiatrists arguing that you know, Ruby had done this because of this condition, and there's various accounts of the jurors just being a bit bored by the whole thing. And the other thing worth saying is, and I hope this isn't getting too much into the weeds, but the thing they had to deal with if they were going for the insanity defense was something called the McNaughton rules, which were basically the criteria for legal insanity at that time in Texas and still in a lot of states at that time, based on something, a case in England in the, I think, 1840s, which basically said that if you're going to say someone's legally insane, they have to have been unaware at the time of the act as to whether what they were doing was right or wrong. And so it had this particular moral angle where you had to prove that, you know, so in the case of Ruby, he was, this condition had brought him to the point where he wasn't aware that that killing Oswald was right or wrong. So anyway, that's the context for it. And yeah, that's what I lay out in part two. And I think hopefully as thoroughly as I could sort of argue why that was always inadequate. And even if you, and then, right, I forgot this, the implication there is that if you're trying to figure out why were all these psychiatrists involved, particularly people like West, you sort of think, well, their argument would be that they actually thought Ruby was insane and that therefore there was, a case of injustice going on. But if you look at the arguments for that insanity that they offered, they were, as far as I can see, pretty bad. There was no clear evidence that he was ever insane. They couldn't convince the jury at the time. The thing they ended up opting for was this thing called psychomotor epilepsy, which they couldn't emphatically prove. Even if you say, okay, what if they were motivated by a sincere, heartfelt sense that Jack Ruby was subject of injustice because he was actually legally insane. Well, the argument that the best psychiatrists in the land put forward was just, doesn't hold up, and it didn't at the time, and there didn't seem to be any clear evidence that it happened. And even then, it's not even something that is possible to happen under epilepsy. So this is all just to say the argument that that's just sort of me checking off one by one the arguments that they put forward or that you could suggest for why there may have been why they may have not been involved for the wrong reasons. You know,
what I take away from it is that they wanted to paint Jack Ruby as someone whose testimony you couldn't trust at all. So therefore, it was meaningless. And if he was just a crazy guy or patriotic or whatever the case was, he just shot him. By no means ever bring up that they knew each other, that there could be a part of a conspiracy, and there could be a darker organization here. That, you know, just you can't believe anything that Ruby says. So let's just put the thing to sleep. The Warren Commission's looked into it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, then that's another thing where, again, I think it's worth just with any of these elements, what always has helped me is just going back to reminding yourself of what the official story is. And if you compare that to what seems to be this clear effort to, I would say, at bare minimum, get control over Ruby, over his, I mean, the other effect of all these people getting involved within days was that they had within days essentially total control of Ruby, of his of who had access to him, of his medical and psychiatric care, and also therefore of and who could reach him, and therefore who he could talk to, and therefore of any information he may or may not have possessed. And I think that's another one of the really clear elements here, is that the effect of all of this is that these people very, very, very quickly, within days, had total control over Ruby, and thus control over any information he possessed. And another thing I don't mention in the article, and I actually want to go back and look into more, was one of the points of agreement between the prosecution and the defense during the trial was when the lawyer Joe Tonahill, on Ruby's defense, said that they should ask that they all agree that, yeah, that Oswald had, and this was before the Warren Commission came out, but that it was Oswald who had shot Kennedy, and that was it. And they all agreed, oh, yeah, that's the story. And so even his defense were, you know, making sure that everyone was on the same page there. And yeah, and so, yeah, the effect of this is that they get control over Ruby, and then the implication is, well, why? What information could he have? If the official story is true, he should have nothing because he's just essentially a loner who, in a moment of passion, killed Oswald. So what information could he have? But obviously then the implication is, well, that's not this true story doesn't line up. And that's what I think all these efforts seem to point to, is an attempt to control the perception of Ruby and any information he could get out. And I guess that leads into what I get into in part three particularly.
Okay. I don't know if you want to touch a little more on that, part three. But okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so part three, so I guess part one is kind of particularly about Melvin Belli and how the defense gets kicked off. Part two is about Hubert Winston Smith and the context there and that defense and how he was involved. And then part three, finally get to Jolly West and what exactly happens there. And so if you're talking about, you know, the question of controlling Ruby and his credibility and any information he might possess, I think, and the mystery that started it all for me, I think, you know, what I get into in part three is really the heart of that, which is that, and again, I think this is something where the understanding of what happened for the decades since has not been as clear as everything I was able to find out, which is that at some point the general understanding is that Ruby had some kind of psychotic episode around about the time when West saw him, what is clear, what is I can prove is that, and this is bizarre, West, I think it was March 26th, I think, no, March 26th, West examined him for the first time. And on the previous night, and after midnight, actually, so technically even the same day, I mean, so this is hours before West first saw him. Jack Ruby has an acute psychotic break, and he's taken to hospital. And as far as I could see, this was the first one he'd ever had. There was no example of anything close to this ever happening in Ruby's life before. And I'm not even clear that another one happened after it. And it started around midnight. Apparently he was playing chess or something with a guard. The guard went out to go and get a glass of water. And then once the guard's going out, this is the story the police department gave. And this is the only story we really have. West mentions it, but only as what the police told him. So for some reason they're playing chess. And then Ruby, as he's got the guards going to get a glass of water, Ruby gets up and I'm sorry about the details here. It's quite a horrific, all of this, what I'm about to get into, but this is what happened. He runs at the wall, the door, to, you know, smash his head against it and try and commit suicide. And then they end up restraining him and get him to hospital. And he's examined there. Well, what happens there is not even, in fact, nothing that whole night is really in the record other than what the sheriff, Bill Decker, said. And what West said in the record, there's barely any information about what actually happened there, other than for some reason Ruby apparently attempted to commit suicide suddenly, while after, you know, in the middle of a game of chess with the guard, and then he goes to the hospital, and then sometime later that day, you know, he's back at the jail, and you know, very shortly after, again, matter of hours later, Jolly West goes and sees him for the first time. And so, but it's not just the story there was that Ruby, something happened that drove him to suddenly try and commit suicide. But what West finds when he goes into the cell is that Ruby was in an acutely psychotic state still, that he was consumed by these, I mean, really terrifying hallucinations that he describes. Where he, I mean, again, this is horrible stuff, but he thought that there was a Holocaust happening in America of Jews. Jack Ruby was Jewish, and that he could heard and according to him knew that the American Jews were being taken down the train tracks, just and that the prison was near Dealey Plaza and the train tracks there, that he you know, millions were being taken on trains, that he could hear his brother being killed out in the street outside. I mean, really terrifying things. And this is what West suddenly walks into. And all of this has suddenly emerged hours, just hours before West, an MKUltra psychiatrist, appears. Yeah, and so the details there are again hazy, but what that enabled West to say in his report, and again, it all comes down to just West's report, that's it. It comes down to him, and he says, Jack Ruby is completely psychotic. He should be hospitalized immediately. The situation has completely changed from when a previous doctor saw him. You know, it's just, there's absolutely no ambiguity. The guy's completely insane and needs, you know, hospitalization and you know, full medical care immediately because of this just terrifying episode that has emerged out of nowhere. Yeah, and so that's kind of the context and what really is the dark heart of this whole thing, really, for me, is that this MKUltra doctor appears out of... And, I mean, the implications here are pretty outlandish, I have to say, and it's partly why I was so thorough with it, because I realized that saying these things was kind of... Well, the implications, yeah, are pretty wild. But, yeah, it's that... Yeah, you've got this MKUltra doctor appearing out of nowhere. Still, there's no, I think, clear or obvious answer as to why exactly it would be West. He appears hours before he sees him. Ruby has this terrifying psychotic episode, which the record lasts, it seems, less than a day based on West's notes. And, well, I'll get into this.
12 hours. Right. I always assumed somebody slipped him some LSD.
Well, yeah, and that's what I... That's another thing I get into, which is that if you've got I mean, this can get into the weeds, but if you've got a psychotic episode that appears out of nowhere and lasts for a briefer period of time, like roughly that, that's hard to explain as it's hard to explain in general, but the most likely cause, and again, this is not speculation, the most likely cause is some substance, you know, that would have induced it. And I've been in touch with a couple of people with training in this area, and yeah, this is particularly the duration of it, it is revealing, because if it's that quick, I mean, you know, it's anyone can, you know, you can figure out it's how long that the thing is in your system for. And so that was another side of it, was the, this whole question of LSD. And West, now, as we may all know, you know, LSD was a big part of all these MKUltra experiments, and West was at the heart of those. And famously, one of the things that I think is more widely known about West is that just a year before, in 1962, at Oklahoma, he had run this infamous experiment, in inverted commas, I don't know what to call it, but where he had tried to induce a state that is naturally occurring in elephants. It's called MUST, and it's something that is something kind of naturally occurring psychosis that occurs, I think, around the time of when they are trying to mate. And yeah, this chemical, or that they weren't clear exactly how it was caused, but he thought, well, if we can trigger, if we can find a way to artificially or intentionally, experimentally induce that state, then we can figure out, you know, how it happened, and therefore perhaps how we could do that to humans, and what the origins of that kind of psychosis might be. And so he'd done this experiment, and it's a horrible thing. They got an elephant, his name was Tusco, and for that they injected him, this elephant, with vast amounts of LSD, trying to induce psychosis in an elephant. West apparently miscalculated the dose, or it wasn't working, and then he put way too high a dose, and the elephant died. I mean, West literally, I mean, he killed an elephant with LSD trying to induce psychosis in it the year before. And that's just one case, you know. But and in his papers, I found records proving that West himself, I mean, we know that, you know, CIA and all these people had direct access to vast amounts of LSD for a long, long time. But West himself, as early as 1959, was getting LSD directly from, and other drugs from, Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, which was the company that handled LSD, and who's one of whose chemists had first synthesized it in the 30s. So West had this stuff and was experimenting on it. And the question of how you can, what it does to the mind, and if it can make you go crazy. And he'd used so much of it that he'd killed an elephant trying to make it psychotic. And yeah, and it's a bleak thing to consider. But when you look at it all, I try to look at every other possible explanation. But from the information we have, it seems to me, honestly, and I worry that I sound crazy saying this, but it seems to me that West, well, the way things line up is that Ruby had this psychotic episode that parallels one that is caused by a substance like LSD. And he has it hours before West appears. And West had also done experiments that were a big part of MKUltra stuff in general. You know, how you can alter what someone thinks during these kind of abnormal states, as they called it.
Yeah, hallucinate.
Right, and also using hypnosis. That's actually, there are letters between West and Sidney Gottlieb that O'Neill found, dating back to, I think, 1953, just less than 2 months after MKUltra was founded. West's writing to Sidney Gottlieb, the guy who managed MKUltra, and he has these many, many pages of detailed breakdown of his plans for a hypnosis research project under the auspices of MKUltra, to, you know, do all these terrible things that to me seem to parallel very clearly what happened to to Ruby. Sorry, I've been going on for a while there, but yeah.
No, it's okay. Probably we should, you know, really urge people to read the article because it's just so much there. And as you mentioned, that all these names keep cropping up. And if you study this dark history of America, you find the same names popping up over, you know, Suran and different things. And just the ideas of, well, did they try to make a Manchurian candidate? Did they really do mind control? You know, did they, you know, in the Allen Memorial Hospital conduct these things? And then you get... you know, it's just, I think there was a documentary I saw called Bad Trip to Edgewood, and that's one of the military installations where they did a lot of this testing, too, on U.S. military soldiers, you know, purposely giving them LSD and that to see how they would react, right?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, another case that involves LSD and all these experiments was the Frank Olson case, which... caused endless trouble for CIA because I'm sure people are familiar with it. It's what's covered in Errol Morris's, I think it's on Netflix, that series, Wormwood, which is, it's about that, where Frank Olson was a researcher, and I think at Edgewood and all these programs, and he went to an event with Sidney Gottlieb and others where they were all given LSD.
A weekend getaway, I think they thought it was, right?
Right. Yeah, a lovely romantic weekend getaway, and they all get given LSD, and then Olson, you know, it triggers something obviously terrible for him, and well, what I think I think it's quite clear that he was killed by the officers of security, in my guess, and that was all, you know, he was a part of this whole thing, so. It's not, this is another thing I wanted to be clear about in the research was, it's not, even though it might sound outlandish, if I were to say to a friend who had no context of all this stuff, hey, so I think that the guy who killed Lee Harvey Oswald, I think a CIA doctor induced, you know, insanity in him with LSD, that sounds a bit wild, but what I wanted to be clear about in the article and for myself and make clear in it all is that this wasn't outlandish. It was very much at the heart of everything at the time. And it might sound crazy, but it was the way they operated.
I mean, to me, and I think people listening to Black Op Radio will just, you know, it's kind of like, oh, that figures. It's just another thing. Bad enough that they killed Kennedy. They just decided to kill him, get away with it. Bad enough that they got the Warren Commission to go along with everything, and then J. Edgar Hoover would turn a blind eye, and then the CIA is covering everything that they helped set up. And then here, Ruby, the guy that they assigned to shoot him. I mean, when you – in the press conference – the night before, right, where they said what organization does he belong to, some kind of Cuban thing, and the guy said, no, it's called the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and then you see that that's Jack Ruby there, you know, dark is this?
I mean, yeah, if you get into the story of Ruby himself, I mean, in all of this, it was, this kind of overlooks Ruby, you know, as the, you know, the person in his life. And that was also something I sort of realized once he kills Oswald, the way I see it is his life, he's just lost any control over anything. I mean, of course, there's a part of that just happens with, you know, being in prison, but his life just became just a sort of a pawn or something that all these figures who emerged out of the woodwork were just basically fighting for control over, and he just disappears into that. He has no say over. And honestly, it makes me, I think Jim said the same thing, it made me feel sorry for him, because you just see this helpless, in a way I can for Oswald, at times, where it's just, you see these people as having absolutely no ability to understand what they were really in the midst of. And And yeah, just kind of at the mercy of these people who, you know, clearly, you know, these people, for whatever they may have done wrong, were, you know, they're humans in the end. And yeah, they were just toyed with and just used completely. But anyway, I don't know where I was going with that, but yeah.
Well, that's fine. I think the in-depth research you've done into these three articles is worth it. I urge everyone to read it, and at least it's going further with the case and on some research that we're all interested in. And it doesn't get any easier to palatable to take. You know, you go, "God, this is really bad. This is bad." You know,
yeah.
You know, like three. What did you say? 4 or 5 days later, they were already planning. Okay, we got to get people in there. We're going to have to make them look crazy. Don't worry, we'll spike his coffee with something. I mean, you know, he's playing chess like right before. You know,
so yeah.
You're using your mind, and all of a sudden,
yeah. I mean, yeah,
the drugs that's kick in.
None of it really makes any sense to, you know, in the way the official story tells it.
Right. You know, if you're looking at the official story, that's where is the contrast. And even if you studied some of these people, like in Saran and Mark David Chapman, and mm-hmm. We were just, you know, earlier talking about these two soldiers at Fort Bragg. Mm-hmm. And I wonder about that kid on the roof that had the assassination attempt on Donald Trump. You know, how the hell did he get up there with a ladder, with a gun, with a rangefinder, and he was there for, I don't know, a minimum 20 minutes, maybe half an hour, you know?
That's bizarre.
And so to the layman here, you go, that doesn't make sense. It doesn't, and unless you go, oh no, they organized it, they planned, they talked the guy in, they hypno-programmed him, they went to his house, they cleaned it secure. You know, you can't do a search for his phone records, and you find out, you know, all these things you find out. And at least with this investigation you've done on Jack Ruby, that you see that there's a team of people. It's not just one guy. There's a whole team of people here to make sure that he looked crazy, that you couldn't trust anything he was going to say, even if he did come out and somehow, you know, he did talk, or if he lived, you know, they weren't going to let him live long enough to talk. But if he did, it would be scrambled that you wouldn't be take it seriously.
Yeah, and I mean, that's another thing. I think it was what I forgot earlier, but it was that he insisted, I mean, except during the trial, but... For the last few years of his life, he insisted that there was a conspiracy, and he pinned it on LBJ particularly. But he mentioned people like H.L. Hunt, the Texas oil guy, and all these people. And so when he was saying to, you know, Warren, that hinting at there being a conspiracy, and that he wanted to be safe in D.C. so he could say it. So he was saying, you know, there was a conspiracy. And of course that was never looked into. So.
And I don't think he even trusted his lawyers,
Tannehill.
And I don't even think his brother was acting on his behalf.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Cause I have a sense that, there was something else going on with the family. And Earl Ruby is very intriguing to me. There's just various things that don't quite, sit right to
right.
me.
And when they don't add up, you should say, listen, you have to look at it from the other side. The fix is in. And if they can't control Ruby and he does leak something, we'll control his brother. So whatever he hands to him, there were certain letters I think he wanted to get out. We've intercepted mm-hmm. them. And then, you know, we don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. And I mean, that's another thing. I mean, there's no way to get into it, but in the article, but Ruby had so many connections to organized crime and across the country, going back to as far back as the 30s, he was close to Mickey Cohen, who Melvin Belli was a lawyer for and a close friend of, and Joe Tannehill, and the guys who Earl Ruby contacted at Jack Ruby's behest in LA just a couple of days after the shooting, they had organized crime connections. And then you've got him, as you said, in the police department when Oswald's a few feet away. correcting a member of the press on such a specific detail that I think this is still worth, you know, thinking about. He's correcting the name of the, you know, the Fair Play for Cuba committee. That's what he shouts out.
Who would know that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Exactly. And when you think what he was correcting, it was the difference between what the other guy had said, the organization the other guy had said, and the Fair Play for Cuba committee is what the other guy had said would have made it a anti-Castro organization. And so by clarifying that it was the Fair Play for Cuba committee, Ruby's clarifying what I would say is the story that Oswald was a pro-Castro guy. And if you think that he really was, you know, doing that, and I think it's clear, I mean, why else would he have said that? If you put that together, then you think, well, he was there. He knew, therefore, that the story, Oswald's story, and knew that it needed to be. I mean,
and
the implications
he
are pretty.
He was going to be part of the con, and he just didn't realize that he was going to be in it. Maybe like Richard Case Nagel recognized something, and he says, "I better be in jail when this happens." So he pulls out a revolver and shoots out.
That was very savvy.
Right. I think you go, there's another little instance that goes, well, that doesn't make sense at all. Or, you know, from the other side.
Yeah. I mean, and another thing, and again, this could take forever, and I think I want to write something else on this, but in the months preceding the assassination, Ruby has a lot of verified calls and meetings with prominent organized crime members. And in literally the days before the assassination, he has several. I mean, I could just quickly run through, you know, those details of just the days before. I think it's around November 11th, so about 11 days, less than 2 weeks before the assassination, three prominent syndicate members come to Dallas and meet Jack Ruby. One of them is a guy called Paul Roland Jones, who's very, very senior in the mob and had been since the 40s. And Ruby also calls a Chicago hitman called Leonard Patrick just days before. I think on the 16th or 17th of November, I mean, this is days before, for some reason he drives overnight from Dallas to Vegas to meet with Lewis McWillie, who is a name some of you may well know, who was very, very prominent in the Trafficante and Myelansky operations. And at that time, he was running the Thunderbird Casino in Vegas, an old friend of Ruby, who Ruby had gone to Cuba with in 1959, allegedly running guns or something like that, and maybe even saw Santos Trafficante in jail. Anyway, all these things. So he goes to see him, I think around a week before the assassination, overnight, and then drives back to Dallas. And in this whole time, he's this is the other side of things with Ruby, that you think, well, what could he? Why would he have been involved? This guy had decades of history with these kind of with these forces that themselves, and of course, intelligence worked with the mob in so many ways, especially, you know, on the Cuba operations, and then you start to just see this whole network of things just falling into place, and the connections, all the meetings Ruby had and the connections he had with syndicate people just days before the assassination, to me, stands out.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
I'm kind of thinking of the old saying. I mean, if you're the Department of Defense and U.S. Steel and the CIA that Kennedy, and Alan Dulles, you go, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So they're reaching out. Listen, to organized crime assets. We're, you know, acquainted with you. We're going to need your help here. We'll pass on the favor when we open up Cuba.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was cut from part one, but because just for space, but something that I found in an old accounts of the Ruby thing is that regarding Melvin Belli getting involved is that one of his law partners, a guy called Seymour Ellison, who had connections to the mob, said, and he said this several times over several decades, including to Warren Hinkle and who's the other, one of the other major, Robert Blakey. He told this story that, and to several others, very consistent over the decades, that on the hours after Oswald was shot, he got a call from a Vegas lawyer who represented the mob saying, and I mean, there's, you know, this is just his word, so, you know, you can't totally verify it, but what I found was that it just lines up with all the details. He says that he got a call from the mob, from a mob lawyer in Vegas saying, one of our guys, referring to Ruby, just shot Oswald. There's a million in it for Melvin Belli, if he takes the case. And yeah, which in itself, I mean, that's something that's, I don't think, really been mentioned in the years since. But that to me is kind of a wild thing, and lines up with the facts, you know, that Belli was involved by the 27th. But the other part of his story is, and this is intriguing, and again, nothing that we can, I don't know what kind of information we would need to be able to absolutely verify it, but the other part of his story, Ellison's story, is that he then got a call later in the day from the same mob lawyer in Vegas saying the deal's off because they heard that Ruby was involved with, quote, another very powerful element who they didn't want to get involved with. So that's just this guy's story. I would say a credible source who spoke to various people who found it credible, kept the same story over decades, and has not been really mentioned much. But, you know, that's another side of it, which is just, I don't know, pretty spooky.
Another anecdote.
Yeah. A lot of people involved is the short way of saying it.
Okay, Max, I've enjoyed your article, and I'm glad that you took time to talk about it. Before we wrap up, is there anything that I didn't get to, that we didn't get to, that you could bring up, or we'll leave the article links on the website here for people to read?
I don't think there's anything particularly we didn't get to. I think I'll write some more on the Ruby case and things I've found that I haven't been able to write out yet, including implications of stuff that happened after what I get to in the article, and some of the things I found about Ruby's earlier life. I think this year I may try and work this material and other stuff into some kind of book of some sort.
Okay, hopefully. Very good. Well, keep in touch with me by with email, and we'll look forward to that. And if it's at Kennedy's and King or even elsewhere, whatever, just let me know, and I'll be glad to help promote that.
Thank you very much. And can I just, one last thing?
Sure.
I'm also currently doing a podcast series with Aaron Good from American Exception. And that covers various things, sort of history of organized crime, relations to intelligence, things like that. But we've already done, there are some episodes out already that discuss Ruby and some of that sordid, dark, complex history of his life. That series is called The Grey Alliance, and it's ongoing right now, but that's another thing I'm working on.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you. And thanks for spending time with Black Op Radio today, and we'll be in touch, I'm sure.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
You're very welcome. Okay, good night.
Good night.